And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I am Grace.
And I am David.
So guys, I want to bring up a little thing because we've talked about a few times on the show, which
little.
Is
oh wait.
Say what?
I was doing the wharf line.
Something.
Little.
Aha, I see. Very, very nice. Okay. So you know, we've talked about how there was that weird thing about how if you remember something different than other people, you must be from an alternate timeline. And it's because some people remembered Chakotay dying in one episode and he didn't, or like he was back later. Well, I think I might be from another timeline because I was watching Star Wars Clone Wars and a character had died and then he came back and everyone acted like that was normal. So I think I might be from an alternate universe where he died. Guys, can anyone confirm this for me? Am I looking hazy around the edges?
Oren, you can't just use alternate timelines as an excuse for your behavior. That might have worked once upon a time in parent-teacher conferences, but it doesn't now, okay?
Look, I remember getting an A. The fact that this says C- just doesn't... It means that I'm from an alternate universe where I got an A, and this is the wrong one. I should go back to the other one, please.
Oren. You need to take accountability for your actions of this timeline. Okay?
Maybe the Clone Wars writers should take responsibility for their actions and not bring back a character they already killed.
Maybe.
It's an anthology-style series. They're allowed to change it around like that.
It is maybe, totally not.
Maybe he was only mostly dead.
That's probably what it was. They just didn't show the part where he woke up in his coffin. It was like, guys, I wasn't actually dead. Why did you bury me without checking? Ugh, rude.
Yeah, that is kind of douche behavior. You know, burying people alive.
Now, yeah. That made me think, aside from red shirts, because I guess they kind of don't count, but I remember in some episodes of Trek, you know, we've seen pretty almost everybody die where Bones looks up and says, he's dead, Jim, and it's a main cast member. And then, but I'm trying to think, in every episode that we see a main person die, do they come back in that same episode? Or was there ever a time where it's like Sulu or somebody, he's like, he's dead, Jim, and they just leave it like that? And then the next episode, he's back. I kind of always thought they somehow bring him back or undo it in that same episode.
Well, the closest to that I can think of is from TOS. One of the, not red shirts, he had a name. I think it was Lieutenant Kyle, but it might have been someone else. There was one of the named...
Lieutenant
you know,
that guy, yeah.
Yeah, one of the named secondary crew members died in an episode, and there was supposed to be a scene where he was brought back, but they cut the scene for time, but he was still back in later episodes. So that's the only one I can think of.
So are you pleading alternate timeline with that one, too?
No, that's just bad writing.
Well, if you remember that episode of Next Generation Parallels, with all them Enterprises, you know, popping in because of that thing, there's all kinds of alternate universes. And like Worf, we jump from one to the other and back and forth, and we have a kid, and then we don't have a kid, and then we're married, and then we're not, and then we have a crazy beard and what. So, yeah, I mean, we could be jumping
the
back and forth
timeline,
now.
Beard timeline, yes.
Can we go back to the one that doesn't have Alexander in it? I'd be happy with that one.
Isn't there one where he has a kid with Troy and stuff like that?
Probably, but it's...
Yeah,
that kid could have been cool, and we'll never know.
I think, I forget the name, it was, if it was, I don't think it was Jean-Luc, but they had a kid, that was the thing. Worf and Troy had a kid, and then she's like, you don't remember blank, whatever their kid's name was, and he's like, I'm sorry. But then he's like, but what about Alexander? And she's like, who, what? And so, yeah, in that timeline where they had a kid, he didn't have Alexander.
And then Worf was happy. Another little bit of non side topic business before we do the main topic for the show is our friend Jera over on Trekkie Feminist posted a pretty neat looking list of all of the female captains in Star that have ever appeared either on screen or been mentioned on screen.
Yeah, it is definitely worth taking a look at, if not just to see how many captains there are that are female, to take a look at the level of diversity among them. It's just cool.
Yeah, and you know, she's got pictures for the ones who actually were on screen. And then in addition to seeing all the women who are captains, you also get to see some of the weird names they gave the ships in, like, cuz some of these ships are taken from like console readouts that you have to zoom in with a magnifying glass in order to,
yeah.
You know, in order to be able to read.
The Easter eggs can get ridiculous sometimes. Let's establish that.
So, like, there's the captain of the USS Elmer Fudd, who I think probably has a spear and magic helmet, but we'll never be clear on that.
Who genuinely in Starfleet thought, yes, this is an honorable name to use, and a dignified and interesting name that will re echo through the ages.
Well, it's probably one of those things where they just thought nobody would notice, right? They were just like, "Hey, we'll put this in and it'll be a tiny thing. No one will ever know, whatever, it'll be fine." And then, along comes the internet and everyone is scouring like every inch of footage and being like, "Hey, look at that. What's up with that guy?"
Clearly, we are
Well,
proof that no one is safe.
there should be a fan fiction or some fan film or who knows what, but basically flesh out a backstory because there could have been, Elmer Fudd was a popular character, and then sometime in the future, somebody names their kid Elmer Fudd, and then that kid grows up to do great things, and then so that's why they're actually naming it the ship after that person who was named after Elmer Fudd. So there's like a whole backstory timeline. That would be cool.
Or a horrible miscommunication of what the Looney Tunes meant to society as a whole.
Well, there were the historical records, so you have to honor the great people.
And their ability to take the to always take the left turn at Albuquerque. Maybe Captain Mary Vandeven was just a big Looney Tunes fan. Maybe she hated rabbits. We'll never know. Or Waddits, excuse me.
Those Wascoey Quingons.
Or I sometimes hear people pronounce it Womuwins, so that's a thing.
Womuwins?
Womuwins.
Womuwins? I'm gonna accept that, I'm just gonna go with that as my explanation right there.
There are worse explanations to be had.
It'll help me sleep at night, so yeah.
So our main topic for today is it's been a while since we've discussed this. I think Bob and I talked about it back in like episode 34, which is like basically prehistory, is the Cardassian culture, which was actually Grace's suggestion, because she thought we've talked about Klingons a lot and a little bit about Romulans. It'd be kind of cool to mention some of the other races in Star
Yeah,
Trek.
fair play. Do a cultural analysis as we will. Or,
I
as
don't.
within our skill set.
But I don't keep up with the Cardassians.
Oh,
Sorry, sorry.
Well, on the bright side, I know what image I'm going to be using for, this posting this
Oh,
on the website.
darn
Now
it.
that we've got that joke out of the way, let us never speak it again.
I'm sure no one will ever make that joke ever again.
No, I'll probably make it like three times before Monday.
So the first thing that becomes apparent to me looking at the way the Cardassian society is organized is that at least in the beginning, it is all built around like a trifecta or a triumvirate, I think is what that's called, because you have the military, the central command, the civilian leadership, which is the Detapa Council, and then you have the secret services, which are the Obsidian Order. And to a
Who we're
certain
not
extent,
supposed to know about.
no, those are secret. Shh.
Shh, a secret third of the government.
Although, I mean, they're not secret in the way that like Section 31 is secret, right? Like people know they exist. They're sort of secret in the way that like the NSA is secret. Like people know
Right.
that they exist, but until recently, nobody knew what they did or had any evidence about it.
That reminds me, recently, just to jump for a second. Somebody mentioned, we were talking about Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and somebody made the comment, for a secret organization, they sure put their logo on their trucks and on everything. And Clark Gregg, he tweeted back that S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't secret, what they do is secret. So that would basically be like the Detapa Council and the NSA and some of these others, where the people know what they are and that they exist, but they don't know everything that's going on and what they're doing. So that's
Yeah,
kind of makes them
so as far as all
mysterious.
the people of New York know, Shield is just like a security systems installer place.
Yeah, just like Brinks Home Security. They put the little cameras, and then they'll call you if they detect smoke or whatever. But that kind of gives it for the Obsidian Order. It kind of made it more mysterious and more scary and creepy because you didn't know what the if you somebody came up to you and said they were Obsidian Order, like, uh-oh, what's going on? What are you doing
We
here?
knew they were powerful, we just didn't know the level of power they would have.
And you know, we never actually do get into the Obsidian Order all that much. Like they actually only feature in a handful of episodes. Like they're introduced, I think, in The Wire is the first episode that they come up in, and that's the one where it's revealed that Garrick has an implant in his brain that it just emits pleasure chemicals, and it's supposed to be an anti-torture device, but being on Deep Space Nine is such torture for him that he just has it on constantly.
God, I'm surrounded by all these idiots.
Just like, to a certain extent, you know, it's too bright, it's too cold, because we've established that Cardassians biologically prefer a darker, much hotter environment than other species do, right? They actually have environmental differences, which is unusual.
Yeah, they're
in Star
lizard
Trek.
People, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they're actually cold-blooded, but they do seem to enjoy, you know, basking on rocks.
Based on some of their behavior, we can say they're cold-blooded.
Well, they're certainly very ruthless. And, you know, you could certainly...
Gold Ducat, that's cold-blooded. Mm-hmm.
Although they do have a definite love of family, which is a little bit different and something we can talk about a little bit later. But the Obsidian Order, after we find out that they exist, basically, in whatchamacallit, The Wire... which is not the HBO television series, by the way.
Yeah, that would be really great, though, a Cardassian version of The Wire, like investigating drug dealing in public Cardassian schools and stuff. That would be amazing.
You know, that leads into something else I wanted to talk about on the same issue, is that show I don't think would be very interesting. Because, you know how, like, a big reason why crime shows are interesting to us is that we have this very intricate system of laws that governs what police can and what the state can and can't do, right? Like, we have, you know, these things called civil liberties. And so the drama of most of these shows comes from the police having to work within this difficult framework, right? And to a certain extent, sometimes the shows kind of forget why we have that framework in the first place, right? It's just like,
right,
you know,
right.
Again... it would be so easy to arrest these criminals if only we didn't have to deal with this Bill of Rights.
But, that old thing.
Yeah, that, you know, I don't even know what they were thinking when they put that in place. But Cardassia clearly does not have that. Like, if you look at the Cardassian judicial system, which we see in a couple of episodes, but most prominently in Tribunal with when they put Miles on trial, is that there really are no limits on the power of the Cardassian state.
Well, I think what they've done on Cardassia, which is kind of brilliant here, is they've taken law shows and, like, police shows one step further and made it so that you can actually enjoy the real thing, but with the same amount of closure at the end of every episode, wherein your criminal of choice dies or is imprisoned or what have you.
You know, the just desserts.
Yeah. And quality programming.
Yeah, you know, you're right. That actually isn't something that I had thought about. But that is true. That's basically, you know, that's why they don't have cop shows on Cardassia. It's because that's what their legal system is.
They don't need them. They got the real thing.
You know, it's just like, they determine ahead of time who is guilty, because the Cardassian system seems to be built on the idea that it is better to imprison 10 innocents than let one guilty man go free.
Yeah, it's like bread and circuses for the pay-per-view crowd.
And it, you know, also has the... Since a huge amount of their system is set up to suppress any kind of dissent, it has that, you know, that little nice bonus, too, where not only can you lock up any people who might have, you know, dissenting opinions, but you can do it in such a way that makes everyone else think you're great.
Just make everything black and white, and then it's a lot easier to decide who's good and bad.
Yeah, which is definitely how the Cardassian society, like, social order is set up, right? At least on the surface. Which is something that, because, like, obviously a huge part of the Cardassian system is set up with this idea of loyalty to the state, like, above all else.
Right. I think that also makes the whole Bajoran-Cardassian war thing a lot easier to swallow for the viewer. This idea of absolute obedience makes it a lot easier to accept this idea that everyone was just like, oh, we're taking over this group of people and occupying their planet. If that's what you think's okay, we're going to do that. But it also makes the whole idea that it kind of romanticizes the idea of the rebellious Cardassians, too, that we see a few of throughout throughout Deep Space Nine mostly, and for one episode of TNG, we see a guy who's just like, yeah, I just want this war to be over. I don't care anymore. So that sensibility really does add a lot to what the kind of stories you're able to tell with a species like that.
Well, that's one of my favorite things about the Cardassians, is that they aren't a uniform block, right? Like you were just mentioning with the dissident movement that they mentioned
right.
a few
they
times.
They present themselves as a uniform block, but as a viewer, we know that's not true.
Right. I mean, you know, that applies pretty much to most oppressive regimes that we've had
absolutely.
Here on Earth, right? Is
yeah.
that, you know, in order for an oppressive, like, conquest-based regime to function, they typically, not always, but typically they set themselves up to be in the situation where it's us versus everyone else, right? It's, you know,
yeah, just look at the Cultural Revolution in China.
Yeah, or, you know, you could also, of course, look at World War II Germany or Japan or
yeah.
even the Soviet Union to a certain extent. I'm sure some people would argue the United States, but since I'm inside the United States, it's kind of hard for me to see that.
Well, go there. You'll get taken away by the Obsidian Order.
Yeah, or the NSA, whoever happens to be around.
And or the Brinks Security Systems people.
Right, you know, those guys, the ones who protect us from alien invaders.
Yeah, we just see their logo everywhere. I'm sure they're good guys, right?
Well, they put, like, a blanket of numbers around my house. I think I've seen that in a Brinks security ad.
It's the Matrix.
One
of the times where we see, like, the people that don't go with the program of the Central Command, one of the episodes I liked was Lower Decks, is that the one with Cito Jaxa, where basically the young Cardassian is saying we don't want, like, he doesn't want the government doing what it's doing,
exactly,
so that's
that
why he's helping.
Exactly, that was the episode I was talking about.
Yeah, that was I really enjoyed that. I mean, because I thought I appreciated the implication that, you know, this one Cardassian, there could be others, and there probably would be a group of them trying to work, you know. And then we see Garrick, who doesn't go with the program. With the whole Cardassian government systems.
Well, although Garrick
kinda,
is interesting.
Kind of does.
I was going to say Garrick is interesting. I mean, an understatement of the century. But in that particular area, because Garrick originally, he starts off really wanting to go with the program. Because, like, Garrick wasn't thrown off of Cardassia because he didn't believe in the system, right? Or at least that's, we don't really know why he was thrown off Cardassia, but that's never implied. Like, you know, he
radical and, fashion statements.
But, yeah, you know, he was.
He was just too fierce.
Those hemlines were that could not be tolerated by the Bureau of Pants Affairs. But
for all we know, on Cardassia, they have a literal fashion police.
They probably do. But that's the thing about Garrick, is that before, you know, he is constantly debating with Bashir about the ethics of the way the Cardassians do things versus the way that the Federation does things. And, you know, it's like with Cardassia, he's all about, he's always talking about how the whole idea is loyalty to the state and absolute morality, right? Things are either good or not good. And it just so happens that being loyal to the state is good and not being loyal to the state is bad. But we also see that Garrick is not, you know, he's not an unchanging person. Like, you know, even he slowly kind of starts to come around a little bit. And at least in the episode Prophet and Lace, where we do see just a straight up members of the dissident movement. Not, did I say Prophet and Lace? I meant Prophet and Loss.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
Prophet and Lace.
You mentioned
not
the unmentionable episode, Oren, and you must be punished for it.
I feel like thinking about Prophet and Lace is punishment for that. I'm like,
ew.
Now it's in my mind. But Prophet and Loss, I should say, that, you know, in that we see Garrick, he is ready to turn over these dissident members in order to, in order to return to Cardassia, basically, in order to get back into Cardassia's good graces. But he eventually decides not to, but if you watch the episode, like, part of the reason he does that is because the Cardassian guy that he was working with turns on him. You know, it's like he does sort of like sympathize with Natima Lang and her cause, but he also is like, well, I want to go back home and this would be my ticket. But that guy who was I was who was going to give it to me is clearly not going to, so I'll help you guys out.
Right, and with Garrick as a character, we also get to see, I think, this really interesting dichotomy that we see a lot in history of people who are part of a state makes right sort of society, whereas there's the problem with having pride in your culture and love of your country and having that be conflicting with your belief system and not trusting the state. And I think that that Garrick is a really cool character in the sense that he kind of epitomizes that as we see him throughout Star Trek, like Deep Space Nine.
And Garrick is also interesting because he is just the tip of an iceberg that we see in, which is this extreme power struggle between individuals in the Cardassian government, right? Which is a bit of a contradiction with their whole loyalty to the state above all, because clearly there are power struggles going on within Cardassia that are weakening the Cardassian state. And so, and again, that is not too dissimilar from what we see in real life regimes that emphasize that sort of thing above all others.
Absolutely.
And, that's, again, the Cardassians, when the Cardassians first showed up in Deep Space Nine, I was kind of like, what are these guys? These guys are just Romulans without cloaking devices. But the more we found out about them, the more interesting I thought they became. Because they seem like a real culture and not like, not like this monoblock, which is ironic because they present themselves as a monoblock, but they clearly aren't, right?
Right.
And I find that interesting. I think that's something that's a lesson that we could learn when you're creating in aliens of all species. Now, granted, it's easier to do in a format like Deep Space Nine, where, Cardassians were featured in I think 78 Deep Space Nine episodes. I was looking up like how many times did Cardassians appear. So they had a lot of time to really develop how the Cardassian culture worked, which I think is something that you should try to do, as much as you can.
Well, it also does make us think as a viewer about cultural perception too, doesn't it? I mean, it makes you think about what the difference between how a people portrays themselves versus their actions and the beliefs of their actual people rather than just what the government wants us to think of them as.
Yeah, I agree. And also another thing about the Cardassians that I thought was really interesting was that there are two alien cultures that the Deep Space Nine really got into over the course of its run, and that was the Ferengi and the Cardassians.
Right.
And I think one of the big advantages that we had with the Cardassians over the Ferengi was that, the Ferengi had been first introduced as being very, basically just galactic clowns. So that was something that Deep Space Nine had to work against. But in the last episode of Deep Space Nine, they sort of hand wave away all of the Ferengi culture's problems. It's just like, oh, okay, I guess the Ferengi are going to become a socialist paradise like the Federation is. And that just seemed very unlikely and didn't make sense with what Ishka had been talking about. That's Quark's mom, for anyone who doesn't remember. And it just seemed very artificial. It was like, well, we have to tie up this Ferengi storyline. So there, it's in a bow, it's done. But
yeah, maybe we can save that for a Ferengi topic week.
Right, I don't want to get into it too much. I'm just using it as contrast. Because the Cardassians, they don't have that moment. Like, the closest we get is Garrick saying that the Cardassia that he knew is gone in the last few. I don't remember exactly which episode it's in, but it's in one of the last few, right? Because the Deep Space Nine basically has like a six-parter as its conclusion.
An intense six-parter.
Yeah. It's really, it's really good for other reasons, but, Garrick says that, no matter what happens, like, Cardassia will not be the same after this because, they've been occupied by the Dominion and they've suffered huge losses and they've had, their entire, identity as being this powerful monolithic group has been destroyed.
Well, right. If they were given a nice hand-wrapped closure ending as a species and as a culture, that would really do them a disservice to all they built them as with this three-dimensional culture that has all these opposing forces of, the state and might makes right versus these individuals and these dissidents. That would really do a disservice to everything that had been established if we just were to take all that and be like, oh, but now it's okay. Now everyone's happy.
Yeah, and then there could be cake and a party.
And then everyone hugs.
Now, but I back to like something that we were original like that we were talking about a little bit earlier was just the this division of power within the Cardassian society is also a case of sort of it seems like one thing, but it's actually something else. Because so you have the you know again you have these the Detapa Council, Central Command, and the Obsidian Order, and those are all clearly those are supposed to have their own defined roles, right? It's like, well, the Obsidian Order is intelligence service, they deal with information. The Detapa Council sees to the political administration of the state, the Cardassian Union, and then the Central Command is the military. They fight martial engagements, basically. That's how it's supposed to be. But right away, we see that that isn't actually what happens. You have the Central Command, which is always fighting with the Detapa Council for power, for political power, because the
Yeah,
Central Command.
and again, we get this concept of what they're presenting Cardassia as and what Cardassia itself actually is. And again, I think that's a big theme with the Cardassians in general, and a big theme in Deep Space Nine, and something we could, really use subtlety-wise in some of the other series is.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, because you have Central Command trying to be they want to be the political force as well as the military force. Like they want to basically run Cardassia. And then you have the Obsidian Order, which clearly has military ambitions. And there's like I find it sort of funny almost that the Obsidian Order are the main people who are going after the dissidents, but the dissidents, their main target is the Central Command, who the Obsidian Order hates. So there's like
Right, kind of
there's
like the Obsidian Order is cleaning up the other department's mess all the time.
yeah like there's no like enemy of my enemy is my friend business going on here. This is
There
just
is no love lost in that fight.
and that's one of my few regrets about the way the Cardassians were portrayed in Deep Space Nine was that I wanted to know more about the Cardassian dissident movement because basically they succeed like off screen. Sort of suddenly, right? Like we don't hear anything from them, and then suddenly they have taken control, and the Detapa Council has exerted its authority and is basically in charge of the state now. And the Central Command has, sort of bowed down and been like, "Okay, we will accept your orders." Which, and so it's talked about like a coup, and we see that all happened off screen, and then immediately the Klingons invade, and then we get the Dominion a little later. So we never really got to see as much as I would like about like how the dissident movement operated and what it's like what was it trying to accomplish, what was its goals, like how did it relate to the existing civilian authorities.
Again, a little just some missed potential there. It would have been really interesting to see, but we didn't get to. So hopefully we can see some more of that worked into the expanded universe or what have you.
Well, you have the Tarak Nor books, don't you?
Yeah, I actually just got them as a gift from Jera this week. So shout out to Jera for providing me reading material and expanding my horizons.
And I can't recommend enough one of the few Star Trek books I've actually read, which is A Stitch in Time by Andrew J. Robinson, the actor who played Garak. And it's about Garak. It's about, how he became an Obsidian Order operative and, how he got kicked out. It's at least, it's what Andrew J. Robinson thinks Garak did to get kicked out. And it's really neat. It kind of expands a bit on the ideas presented, already in the show. So I like it a lot. I think it's good. And I know that there are some of the expanded universe novels also talk about what Cardassia looks like after the Dominion War and like how they go about
Ooh,
trying to rebuild.
that would be interesting to see how they sort of reconstruct themselves after that enormous breakdown.
Yeah, I would really like to have seen that as well. This is why one of the reasons I think a cool show, this would be kind of a niche show. I don't know if they could ever make it work on primetime, but like a show about dealing with the post-Dominion War. Because, obviously the Dominion War was a huge conflict that changed everything, and it's like, well, how do we go on after that, right? Like, what's the rebuilding process look like?
Well, that was
And
kind of what the basis for the start of Deep Space Nine was, though, wasn't it? The fallout after this war between the Bajorans and the Cardassians that we'd only seen a little bit of in Next Generation, and then the fallout is the start of the story for Deep Space Nine. So that is a really good starting off point.
Yeah, and I mean those are some of the better episodes of Deep Space Nine when they're dealing with the sort of the factionalism going on within the Bajorans. And so yeah, I think that that's a good story, and I would like to see it writ large, as it were. I want to see what that looks like on a, you know, on a quadrant scale. Another interesting thing about the Cardassians that, and again, this is one of the reasons I like them, is because they have values outside of what of their initial presentation as, you know, just sort of scheming bad guys, is their family system.
Right, again, that adds to them as a society and makes them more than this initial thing that we kind of got with the Ferengi, if they're just like, oh no, we're all about profit, 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 that's all we're about. But the Cardassians get that level of dimensionality that makes them really interesting.
Right, because they seem to the Cardassians place they have an extreme value on family, to and you know, obvious that seems like it might be obvious, like, you know, everyone would be like, well, family is important to us too, and, you know, to a certain extent it's important to everyone, but the Cardassians not only like family is everything, but it's also like it's how they structure their lives, right? Like, you know, they all they, there's implications that they all basically families all live together. It's like, you know, you're not going to go and leave your family home and move halfway across the country to go to college on Cardassia. That doesn't seem to be how it works.
Yeah, but didn't you love it that they took that it was a powerful society where they really do believe that might makes right and they're very family based, but didn't go with the sort of stereotypical mafioso thing? I'm really glad they didn't go in that direction.
Well, what do you mean? I want to know more.
I mean that, generally speaking, in our culture, when we think family and power, we think of a mob kind of like that, don't we? That's just sort of a cultural thing that comes to mind when we think of power and family and relating
And
the two together as a
there's
society.
almost what you're saying there almost has, you know, shades for the Klingons, because if you look at the House of
Right,
Mold, the
right.
House of this, and you know,
Exactly.
either whether it's a actual bloodline house, you know, family, or the way we see Klingons could have, you know, adopted or incorporated people to where it's like a clan unit or whatever. They and families and houses would, you know, bicker and have rivalries and war against each other, but it's not to the same level of organized crime like the mafia. But I see what you're saying with it almost, because even though that happens in the Klingon culture, it's not the primary focus. It's like that's not how they do.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas with the Cardassians, you could almost see it would be easy to say, well, let's take that Klingon model and just ramp
It
it
would have been
up.
a really easy trope for them to go with, I feel like, and I'm glad they didn't, and I feel like that
Right.
really added something.
And
Well,
the way I know I looked at, because we saw it with a lot with Dukat, and then glimpses here and there, I always saw the family importance almost like mirroring other parts of the government and other things, where it's really about the unit, like, you know, the family unit, and then thinking of Cardassia as a, you know, the in a governmental larger scale, like they want to have that be a one cohesive, you know, strong unit. And so when it went to the family, it kind of made me think of like they would, it wouldn't be exactly the same, but they would, you could think of Dukat or some of these other gulls and everything, like having a long lineage and, you know, taking pride in the children's accomplishments and all of that. So that's why when we see, you
right,
know,
just like the family line of accomplishments and the sort of nepotism that can come with that.
right, and if you got a strong goal, you know, his he they would be priming their children to take o to
Like the
become goals and take
Kennedys, like the
over.
Kennedys.
And so if you get to, you know, in one way it would be like, because Dukat was disgraced about having the daughter out of wedlock thing. Like you could see, like in some cultures, you have a very powerful, strong, respected general, and their kid is off doing crazy stuff, and they're like, "Oh, kids, whatever." Whereas with Cardassia, that would be a really like a big, you know, smear on their reputation for the parent, for the you know, for Dukat, that people are going to look to his family and go, "Oh, look what's going on there. He's not got his house in order," type of thing, or he's not
And
having.
that was part of the big deal that they made about his character and about the problem with Zial and the problem with kind of why he ends up leaving Cardassia for a while, it doesn't it?
Which I thought was beautifully ironic that he ended up being disgraced because of Zial, when he had basically tried to do the same thing a few seasons earlier, if you recall,
Right?
in the episodes of Cardassians. He had apparently, this was like, he had set this plot up like years in advance, where he had basically kidnapped a child from one of his political enemies and made it look like that child had died in a Bajoran attack, and then like hidden the child away so he could trot it back out later and be like, see what a terrible father this guy is? Look at him. He's awful. And, you know, that was, so that when you think about it, that was a incredibly long ranging plot. You know, the Cardassians do not mess around when they, you know, when they start planning your downfall.
No, and that just makes the whole story with Zia all the more, oh, look what you did, you done goofed.
Which is, you know, and again, this is where we see, again, with the Cardassians being a culture of contradictions, which, you know, much like our culture is.
Contradictions are hypocritical.
No, I mean, it's true. It is hypocritical to a certain extent, because they're talking about how, man, the family unit is important. The family is everything. But clearly all of these Cardassian officers are indulging in, quote, comfort women, unquote, among the Bajorans, which is an uncomfortable enough topic in and of itself. And certainly,
right.
But is also, like, you know, really, if family was everything to these people, they probably wouldn't be doing that.
Again, another contradiction in how they present themselves versus how they actually are.
Which is, you know, and I like that. I think that, you know, it's, you can sometimes have, like, continuity errors, basically, where you present a race one way, one episode, and then you present them another way, a different episode. But I thought with the Cardassians, it was more that, like you said, it was a clear difference in that how they would like to think of themselves versus what the reality was, and not so much, you know, it wasn't like... Right. You know, in the episode where they talked about having, you know, having Cardassians with Bajoran mistresses, it wasn't like they'd suddenly forgotten how important family was to the Cardassian culture. It was just like, hey, there's more than one level of that. We also know that... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it seems like a lot of this might have come out of there's a sort of soft canon assumption that Cardassia is a resource-poor world. And I don't know if that is ever actually said on screen at any point. And apparently, I don't know why I can't load the chat room or I would ask them. But it seems like that Cardassia did not have a lot of resources. Like, it was a very difficult world to survive on. Like, everything we've seen of it suggests that it's largely a very dry climate. And,
they're big on importing and exporting, I guess.
Yeah, and so the Cardassians... Not only did they have to expand to grab resources, which explains part of their super militaristic mindset, and part of why they thought it was okay to strip mine Bajor for everything it was worth, because that's just what they've been doing for so long. But also, it sort of feeds into why they have such huge families, because, like, you know, Dukat has 8 children, counting Zial. And we know that, the fertility is considered an important thing, because if you remember in the episode, Destiny, when there's that kind of, you know, somewhat comical but also somewhat sad misunderstanding between O'Brien and that Cardassian woman, where she thinks he's coming on to him, and she thinks he's coming on to her, and he thinks that they're just arguing. Like, at one point, she mentions, "Don't worry, I'm very fertile. I can have lots of kids," which is, you know, not exactly something you expect to hear when you're talking to someone you're courting, but that's apparently an important thing in Cardassian society, which is, you know, and that is something you see in resource poor situations, which is kind of ironic, is that when you have fewer resources, you have more children.
Because then there are more people to help you gather resources.
Yeah, and because also you need to kind of employ a shotgun approach, because otherwise your children might all die before they reach adulthood. Which is, you know, as a side tangent, is why the birth rate tends to go down when there are, you know, when you have a higher standard of living.
The more you know.
Yeah.
Well, and I kind of had the same inference, or I don't know, I had the same idea kind of about at least in the past for the Cardassians, that they were a resource poor, and that was kind of similar with the Klingons. They said that Kronos was a resource poor culture and our planet, and then you know, they build it up and they are used to adversity and being, you know, the odds against them. And so then they build it up and here comes the Herc and the Tribbles and they're like, you know, we can't let this happen. And so that kind of made me think, you know, if the Klingons dealt with a resource poor planet or, you know, region, and then the Cardassians are dealing with that, it almost kind of implies that there would be elements or, you know, groups out in the galaxy where in some cases you have a resource rich area, like in a big planet of abundance, and that flourishes the culture. But then there's these others who have, you know, a hard time and they struggle to build themselves up. And so that might make them more aggressive or militaristic or more defensive because they've had to, you know, build up through adversity and difficulty and then protect their resources, where some other lush planet would be like, you know, come enjoy our fruits, you know, and be more open. And so that might give little insights into maybe the Federation and some of the other planets, because not every planet is going to, or system is going to be full of the minerals and all the stuff that you would need to build up an empire. So maybe that's why they would go out and conquer and try to incorporate others.
Yeah, like a resource rich planet like Earth, really. Which say what, Grace?
No, I was just saying spooky.
Yeah.
What if the Cardassians came after Earth?
Well, I mean, you know, we do have this nice system full of rocky planets, full of metals and stuff. Maybe that's what they're after. But I think it's interesting so far we have two major races in Star Trek that have these, you know, resource poor home planets as kind of a backdrop for their expansionistic policies, which are, you know, both Cardassians and the Klingons. But it's interesting to me to look at and compare the two and how they work, because so with the Klingons, with their like family structure, that's actually how they decide political matters. Like, it's all, you know, each great house has a seat on the High Council. It's not like the High Council is not like an elected body, right? Where you get chosen by a constituency. It's like you get to be on the High Council because someone decided that your bloodline was important enough to be there, and you're the eldest male, I guess. Whereas, and like, you know,
well,
as
but
a,
hold on though, that would be the noble houses, and some of those, there's, you know, in some of the lore, there's they call them noble houses because they're supposedly bloodline ties back to Kalis. But if we remember, at different times with the Klingons, you could have a house that rises to power, either economically or militarily or in influence, and then a seat on the council has been seen as a bargaining chip at times, where it's like, if you do this for me, I could get you a seat on the council. So it's not just, you know, the bloodlines or the royal, the noble houses, because, you know, it,
blood isn't as important as they like to say it is.
Well, that's like the higher level. And those are probably the bloodlines are the noble houses are probably the ones that can't really be. I mean, look at Duras. They were protecting him and, you know, lying and cheating and changing, you know, the history or the accounts of it to protect that. Whereas you might have a smaller house that's not a noble house that rises to power. They get a seat on the council and then something could happen where they get kicked off the council. So it's kind of like a mixture of the noble houses and sometimes they say the great houses or just the, you know, the rich, whatever. So you would have a council where they all have to decide together and they're not elected. They're not, you know, you don't have the annual or every 4 years or whatever. You don't vote for who's on the council. It's kind of like the council has to bring you in or whatever. So that's definitely a different structure than the Cardassians.
Right, and with the Cardassians, they have a much more structured political system where like family is still considered very important, but it's like it's almost more of a, it's less of a family is the way that we decide how things are done versus a family is how we judge you. That's kind of how it seems to be. It's like it isn't so much that you have these political dynasties where, you know, one Dukat will rule after another Dukat, so much as, because theoretically, I think Dukat is actually his last name. I don't think we ever learned what Gul Dukat's first name was.
Yeah.
It was Gul, is what it was. That was a misunderstanding. Gul's not actually a rank.
He was actually named Gul. His parents had really high hopes for him.
Yeah. So instead, it's like, you know, once family is just a thing you're expected to have when you're in a high position of power. And if you don't have it, or if your family doesn't measure up to the cultural expectations, you are judged harshly, as we saw. Now, since we're coming up on our last 10 minutes, since we do have to end at 2 today, I wanted to talk a little bit about the gender roles as we see them in, oops, I think we lost Grace. Oh no. David, are you seeing the same thing I'm seeing on TeamSpeak?
Yeah, I don't know if she must have got disconnected.
Huh. Well.
Yeah, it says connection connection lost. We'll try to get her back.
All right. Yeah, I mean, she's actually in the next room from me right now, so I'm sure she probably is having a laptop issue. Here, David, just vent for 1 second. I'll be right back.
Oh, there we go. She looks like she's coming back, and we have to grant talk power. Okay, are you back? You sounding good?
I'm back. I'm back. Okay, cool. I just got disconnected from TeamSpeak.
Just flipped a table. It's just like, I'm so mad about this subject that Oren wants to talk about. Just like,
God. I know. I guess TeamSpeak was raised in a very strict familial unit where you obey the state.
Now, what I was talking about is since we have about 10 more minutes, is I wanted to discuss the gender roles as we've seen them laid out in,
that's
in,
right,
in Cardassian,
yeah,
culture. And they're not... The only time I can ever recall them specifically saying a gender role was in the episode Destiny, when that scientist that was courting O'Brien said that women dominate the sciences because men are bad at science.
Men are bad at science. Can I get that on a t-shirt?
Well, I mean, it's a Cardassian thing. It must be true. And it does, ironically, even though that's not true for humans in real life, it is becoming true for humans in fiction. Like, I don't know if you've noticed, but nowadays it seems like when you make a sci-fi movie, scientist is the girl job. That seems to be a thing now. I don't know why.
I don't know. There's still a lot of people saying we need better representation for women in the scientists and in the sciences in popular culture.
That's
so it might
probably
be on the
true.
Rise, but it's still hardly ideal.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. That's certainly, I'm sure we're not at parity yet or anything resembling it. But so that's the only time that I can think of very specifically getting a, like, you know, an explanation of how the two genders operate in Cardassian society. But just looking from what we see, it seems like women in Cardassia have a lot of influence in, like, the judicial and even within the intelligence community, because, you know, the big, like, high Cardassian judge that we saw in Tribunal, who clearly had a lot of political authority, she was female.
Right.
And we saw a number of female Obsidian Order agents. One of them was actually in the episode Defiant, where they were hunting for the Defiant, interestingly enough. And Dukat was in charge of that, and this Obsidian Order lady was giving him sass. Being like, you're real lame at this, Dukat. If only you were better at your job, things would be okay.
Why are you not good enough? Why?
So clearly there's influence there. And we also, of course, saw that, you know, Natima Lang, who was a very influential member of the dissident movement, she was female. So there's clearly, you know, if there is a cultural stigma against women in politics, it must not be that strong because we see a lot of them. But the Cardassian military is almost 100% male. Like,
right.
I looked around and I tried to find some, and I could only find two references to Cardassian female military personnel. One of them was in the episode Cardassians, where they mention a female Cardassian officer, which they specifically mention. They're like, oh, it was a woman, and they seem to think that's strange. And then in the alternate universe, there is a Cardassian female guard standing around. And that's
always,
like,
with the alternate universes.
Yeah, and that was notable enough that it got on Memory Alpha. So,
well, gee, yeah. Cardassian military really needs to step it up.
So that, you know, that's just some, and considering, you know, it's not like Starfleet has perfect parity either. And part of that is, I think, more just because of the truth of television, where it's like Starfleet is supposed to be a non-discriminatory organization. But clearly, when we're casting television shows, there's still a, unless it's a show specifically made to be targeted at women, there's generally an assumption that there will be a majority male cast.
There's always that assumption, yeah.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, but that's the reason why I think why there are more male Starfleet officers than there are female ones, not because in universe there are supposed to be. And compared to the Cardassians, the Federation has gender diversity, you know, going on. They know what's up.
Comparatively speaking, but yeah.
And I always wondered if that was something that the Cardassian that like the writers set up on purpose. Like, you know, did they know they were like, well, in Cardassia, the political power is split fairly evenly, but in military terms, it's like, you know, that's considered to be a man's responsibility or what have you, or is that just something that happened because the Cardassians are bad guys, and generally speaking, when you have a evil aliens, they're usually going to be male. Not always. We do have the female
No, but
changeling.
usually, unless they're supposed to be like sexy, seductive bad guys,
Yeah,
that's the
that's.
standard.
So I was always just wondering if that was something that they did on purpose or not.
That would be worth looking into.
They also seem to have a f like the family structure, which is ironic because they talk about family all the time, but we don't really see exactly. Like, you know, how does the division of labor within the family work exactly? Like, are women still expected to be the primary caregivers? We can assume that based on the fact that all these Cardassian men are off in the military. That seems like that would probably be the case.
Well, the problem is that we don't see a lot of the Cardassians on world, so we don't get to see a lot of the domestic life of the Cardassians, which sounds like a really weird book.
Grace, I think we lost your audio. All right. Well, I
Yeah,
think,
last thing I heard was weird.
yeah.
And that was the thing I kind of was disappointed a little bit about with DS9. Was that we didn't get to see, and it's not just the Cardassians. In a way, for all of Star Trek, we don't really get a lot of civilian life or homeworld views. So I was wanting to see more of that on for the Cardassians, like how do they, daily life and civilian life.
It's always nice to see because it rounds out a culture as a whole, which really would benefit them on a show that's supposed to be about all these different cultures interacting.
Yeah, which is why I really would like to see in a future Star Trek series something that is not based in the Federation. And you could have a Federation character if you felt it was necessary to have an audience POV character. And that's one of the reasons why I really liked at least the first few episodes that I saw of Defiance, which is that sci-fi show that's based on the MMO of all things. But it actually was very interesting. It actually went into the alien cultures and actually, showed them just living their lives, not just how they look from a human's perspective, which I thought would be something Star Trek could really benefit from.
Yeah, for a show about aliens and space exploration, it's still pretty anthropocentric.
Well, it's all going to be human centric. That's sort of the standard, and I think Star Trek of most of these shows, Star Trek does the best job of deviating from it, but it could still do better. We could still have more non-humans and be more expansive in what we're looking at.
There can always be more aliens.
And that's easier for them to do in the books, right? Because like especially, to some extent it's a practical consideration because
Well, yeah,
Cardassian.
budgetary restraints and what have you. There's only so much you're allowed to actually show on TV.
Yeah, Cardassian makeup's expensive, which is another reason why it needs to be an animated series. Come on, guys. I don't want another animated series. I want one that's good. But we're about at the end of our 1 hour
Dare to
for
keep
today.
dreaming, Warren.
I do dare to keep dreaming. So final thoughts on the Cardassians. David, why don't you go? You haven't had as much chance to talk today.
Well, I was happy to see the development over time because obviously we get to see them introduced in the Next Generation, and they're kind of weird looking compared. They got the weird outfit compared to what we see later, and they were just I'm a bad guy and that's all I am. And so over time we got to see more of it, and I've gone through the hating the Cardassians, and then at a certain point kind of trying to not empathize with them, but kind of like see them as not just like, I just hate them. And so they were, especially as they were developing some of the characters and the culture and the government and everything. And so I wouldn't necessarily say liking the Cardassians, but thinking, okay, they're interesting and I want to know more. And then, it would kind of then with the Dominion, I started hating them again because they were, you know, working with the Dominion. So it's been an up and down roller coaster with the Cardassians, but I've been happy to see them fleshed out. And there's a lot of people who want to see them as a playable faction in Star Trek Online. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but
would be really cool.
You know, with the original series, it was basically humans, and then we had Romulan, Vulcan, and Klingon as like the primary aliens. And so for TNG and DS9, you know, I think it's cool and well done to have Cardassians be one of the pillars of the alien races. I think they were, obviously more could be done with it, but I think they've been handled, you know, decently.
There's definitely more to be done, but I think they're a really good example of what you can do with universe expansion through just working with one group of people. And I feel like they grew a lot from the first look we got at them, needless to say, but they became very interesting, and I'd really like to see more done with them.
All right, well, I couldn't agree more with that. So we are a bit out of our time for this week, but I hope you guys will join us all next week when we have special guests Kathy Ferguson and Jera Haj on the show to discuss motherhood and pregnancy and the way it's presented in Star Trek. So that will
be
next week.
It's going to be one mother of an episode.
Oh.
You're welcome.
I don't know if I'm going to be allowed to put that in the podcast, Grace. iTunes might censor that. But all right.
We don't know.
I hope you'll join us all next week. And until then, this will be All Things Trek signing off.